welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together to address problems instead of defending positions. As we're caught in the swirl of the most toxic and maybe dangerous election of our lifetimes, citizens from across the political spectrum are asking two questions. How did it get this way? And how do we restore the missing piece in government of, by, and for the people? The people! Well, if you had a sense that the will of the ordinary citizen in America has little or no impact on what legislation actually gets passed, you're right. There was a study conducted by Princeton University in 2014 that concluded, and I quote, "The preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy." Could this be why fewer Americans exercise their right to vote than any other democratic country in the world? Might it be that we need to rename our system feudalism, as in F-U-T-I-L-E, because of the futility of voting for a candidate who does the bidding of the highest bidder instead of doing your bidding? Well, our guest this week, Richard Lang, has come up with a meta-strategy for bringing the collective and amplified voice of we the people to the forefront of politics. The idea begins with an observation. For the first time in known human history, it is now possible to convene an unlimited number of citizens in one place at one time to cast collective, non-binding advisory votes on any issue of collective concern or importance. Digitally. Think of it as freedom of assembly 3.0. Richard Lang is a software developer who launched a highly successful company, Burst.com, in the 1990s, launched another company, Democrasoft, to help evolve democracy and empower individuals in the 21st century, and has written a book, Virtual Country, which proposes this plan for advisory voting that we'll discuss today. Quote from Richard. We are talking about a new national institution for civic engagement focused on issues instead of political parties and blind ideology. A powerful new counterbalance to the corrupting influence of big money and politics. Unquote. Imagine, if you will, a space, non-governmental, non-corporate, non-partisan, independent of the mainstream media, where each citizen can have a voice and a verifiable vote, and these votes can be tabulated to indicate not just how citizens feel about certain issues, but how strongly they feel. What if 10 or 20 or 50 million American voters declared, we want this? What would happen? While that vote would have no legal standing, it'd be an advisory vote, simply recognizing the overwhelming support for a certain policy would provide pressure on legislators to adhere to the people's will or face opposition at the polls. Okay, well, we're going to talk about this today. What if we use technology wisely and consciously, not to shape public opinion, but to galvanize public will? What if we took advantage of the handheld device that even homeless people own to bring people together in an entirely new ecosystem for civic engagement that will evolve democracy into the 21st century. So I'm excited about our conversation. Welcome, Richard Lang.
Well, thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me as part of your program. Looking forward to our conversation.
Good. Well, you know, we've known each other for a number of years. I've seen the great potential for the National Town Square and advisory voting since I first heard about it. In fact, you were among my first interviewees on WikiPolitiki when we started a little over 3 years ago. So for my listeners not yet familiar with your idea, tell us a bit about the National Town Square Virtual Democracy Advisory Voting, how it came about, and how it's evolved over the past several months.
Well, let me start by saying that, you know, in my book, Virtual Country, I had focused on the idea of establishing a new national institution for advisory voting. But, you know, the National Town Square by any name is really best thought of as the venue for the real innovation that we're going to talk about, which is advisory voting, something that has not existed in our democracy up until now, and primarily because it hasn't really been possible. And so let me start by defining what I mean. I think what we both know from our conversations, I mean by the term advisory voting. So, you know, when we think of voting generally, we think of elections, right? We think every couple of years there's an election, every 4 years it's a big one. You know, this year it's an unbelievably important one. But what happens is we think of our vote. That's our voice. We have an individual vote, and we get to exercise it once every 2 years at best. And we know just statistically that in most cases, the turnout, the participation, never goes above 60% of those who are eligible to vote. But, you know, that said, the 60% or the 52% or whatever the amount is of people who do turn out to vote because they do care, that's what we call civic engagement. Advisory voting is different than that. What it addresses is not so much elections and electing our representatives that will then serve, but rather it's providing collective input to those elected representatives in between elections, empowering ourselves to have an advisory voice in between elections with which we can weigh in on issues that we, the people, choose ourselves through the process of advisory voting. So, you know, advisory voting, it means literally non-binding, right? It has no legal impact. So why do it? And what would it mean? Well, let me back up a little bit and look at it historically. We have three branches of government. And of course, you know, when our country was formed, you know, that was just a great design. It's worked great for, you know, more than 240 years. But it was designed based upon the technology of the times. And, you know, in 1786, there was no capability to count people. And ultimately, advisory voting is a way of counting ourselves. So what it means is that in between elections, it is now possible, and it has been for about the last 10 years, to provide each citizen with the ability to claim their advisory voting account, which essentially is secure like a bank account, just like you log into your online bank to do financial transactions, you would log into your online advisory voting account, which you can access on your mobile device or on a computer or the library. And once you've logged in, you would be presented with the essence of an issue on a single page. Here's the issue, or here's the question that we want to consider. Here is some educational material, likely in the form of a video, but also some other supplemental information. Not unlike you might find in a voter's guide during an election, right? Telling you a little bit about the issue, who supports it, who doesn't, what some of the arguments are. But then there would be a way for citizens to weigh in. and say, okay, well, now that I've learned a little bit about this issue or a lot about it, depending upon how much time I'm spending with the educational material, I can cast an advisory vote. And that vote doesn't have to be, you know, binary. It doesn't have to be yes or no on a particular issue, although it, you know, many times it will be. But it could also be in the form of voicing priorities. Like, you know, here's, for instance, 10 categories where we spend federal tax dollars. Let's drag and drop them into the order that each individual thinks is the best priority. And then the advisory voting mechanism will generate immediately an ongoing consensus of here's what all of us together believe. So I'm getting a little bit into the weeds, but, you know, the essence of this is that we can have input between elections that's advisory in nature. And the last point I want to make in addressing the definition is the most fundamental and important part of advisory voting is not how people vote on any given issue. It's the fact that we have, for the first time in our history, known history as humans, the capability, the technology to enable 150, 200 million, you know, all of us to show up easily in at any time online in a secure way and be counted. And so more important than how we vote is how many of us vote, because it's a natural way to gauge the importance of an issue by how many people feel it's worth showing up to weigh in on it, right? So we not only get a chance to say how we feel, but collectively we get this this beautiful way of adding our individual votes to a collective voice, and establishing that collective voice is what advisory voting is all about.
You know, it's really interesting, but what seems to be missing in government of, by, and for the people is, of course, the people. And having that coherent voice, you know, we've seen so many studies that show that most people, there are certain issues, like, for example, money in politics. There's something like 85 or 90% of people who believe that there's too much money in politics. There's a lot of things where there's a great deal of agreement, but because of how the political parties have manipulated the narrative, is there's no place until now where voters can be essentially liberated from their political party narratives when they deviate from those narratives. So I think that that's really an important point that you bring up, that all of a sudden people can be liberated from the political parties and speak their own heart, and lo and behold, something that the majority of people agree on, we can cohere around and speak in one voice.
Well, that's you bring up a good point, Stephen, and let me expound on that a little bit because it's very important. In advisory voting, there are no political parties. The mechanism that's envisioned would collect zero data other than what's necessary to validate, to, you know, the login that the person who says they are who they say they are is actually that person, just like in a bank account. That data, which is just authentication, and the zip code. We want to know where they are, but beyond that, we would not collect any data about what political party, their preferences, demographics, and why is that, okay? It seems counter to what we've come to expect. I mean, we see social networks and, you know, Facebook, and it's all about data. And I'm sure we're going to get into a conversation about how that data is manipulated. But the reality is, as soon as we identify ourselves as being a Republican or a Democrat or a, you know, liberal or conservative, instantly we have polarization that takes place. People become tribal. We stop really even trying to have a civil dialogue, or let alone a consensus about anything. In advisory voting, what's envisioned is that citizens are presented with one issue at a time, and it's not a conversation place. It's not a place like Facebook where you get to bring in a link and, you know, and show somebody a video and make your argument and go back and forth. There are plenty of opportunities for that in a larger ecosystem for civic engagement. But advisory voting per se is simply an opportunity to leave those labels behind and just as an individual on a particular issue say, okay, well, on this issue, here is how I feel as an advisory voter. And that's important because it comes back to the points you made a moment ago. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Harvard did a study on how many people agree, and it turns out that it's more than 80% agree on almost everything of we citizens. But we wouldn't know that because the two-party system is designed so that as soon as you hear the first issue that you disagree with someone on, okay, they're on the other side, you know, we're not talking anymore. But with advisory voting, all that goes away. Instead, what you get is, okay, here's the issue for today. It happens to be, you know, should we have witnesses in the impeachment trial, for instance, right? Now, it may be that the people end up, based on their politics, have a view one way or the other, but it's a good example that I'm using because in the actual impeachment hearings, 75% of all of those polled said that they wanted to hear witnesses and see documents in the trial. And that's across the board. Like, you know, regardless of political party, 75% of us agreed that that's what we wanted. And yet, that was completely ignored. And why was that? Because it was a poll. And it's a very important distinction between a poll and advisory voting. In a poll, the only people who really have a stake in it, barely, are the people who have been interviewed for the poll. 1,100 people, 900 people, at the most 1,500 people out of a nation of 240 million eligible voters. We've heard from 1,000 people. Well, that's, you know, the politicians who hear about that poll or read about that poll, in this case it was, you know, in the U.S. Senate, there's no pressure on them to do anything. Now, imagine the same scenario if there had been a way to log into one's advisory voting account and say, okay, here's the question. Should the Senate entertain witnesses and documents as part of having the trial? And suddenly, instead of 1,100 people being polled, you had 150 million people, 75% of which said, yes, we want to hear witnesses. Especially once you see a map of where those zip codes are, you know, there is no way that that collective voice could have been ignored because the writing would be on the wall for the next elections. It would be the only thing that any news outlets or pundits or even, you know, kitchen table conversations would be focused on is, wow, 150 million people, 75% of them said we want to hear witnesses. Well, that would have been a different outcome. And, you know, it's because the number of participants would have been louder than the absence of that, than 1,100 people in a poll. And that's what moves politicians. You know, we know that when enough people show up, things happen. We know that from the way the Do Not Call list, you know, a few years ago came to become legislation when suddenly there were, you know, at that time it wasn't even millions of people. It was, you know, 75,000 people ended up signing a petition online and saying, I don't want to be called. And then initially, you know, it started off slow and suddenly it was a bunch of people. It were millions of people. And within a few weeks, it became law. Because people voted on that issue in an advisory sense. They weren't electing someone. They were saying, here's what we want. And so, you know, that becomes the power of a collective voice.
Richard, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Richard Lang and talking about advisory voting. Steve Behrman here on WikiPoliticky.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization Their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
A social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others, and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, this is Steve Behrman. I'm back with our guest, Richard Lang. We're talking about advisory voting. And I think that you really set up a really very interesting scenario, imagining that people, all they have to do is to use their personal device and voice their vote. It probably would take really just a matter of a minute or so, and people can show up that way. Just to clarify, how do we know that these are real people? Because after all, you know, we've been inundated with so many bots and fake personas on the social media. How would this be guaranteed?
Well, first of all, remember that this is not a social network, right? It's an important distinction, because we're used to thinking like that. But think of it more like an authenticated bank account, right? The same technology that enables any one of us who wants to download an app for our bank and to sign in. There's, you know, multiple authentication processes, but, you know, none of them are rocket science. This is already known. So at the point at which an advisory voting account is initially established, it's not just possible, the process would be to establish that a participant is a U.S. citizen, voting age, 18 years or older, and then it just becomes just like a bank account, except it's a voting account. Now, I think probably the more important question, which you probably were going to get to, but it has to do with, you know, who would oversee this, right? So, you know, who's doing the counting, in other words? And this is where we come back to far more important than the technology, because the ability to count ourselves is already there. The technology is there, but what's not, one of the issues, the biggest one probably that we face in our democracy right now is trust. There's a lack of trust in our institutions. And, you know, that's gotten much worse, unfortunately, I believe by design over the last 3 years or so. But, you know, regardless, the opportunity to set up an advisory voting system is also an opportunity to reestablish a trustworthy national institution dedicated to operating an advisory voting system. So, you know, those of us that have been working on this initiative and have made good progress, I might add, you know, that has become the first and most important layer, a nonprofit organization, transparently run by a mission statement and operating principles that set forth the ground rules that all of us can depend on in order to trust the institution. It includes the ability to for the advisory voting topics to be presented with factually verified educational material that even people who have completely opposing views on an individual issue will still agree that the factual information is what it is, that, you know, we don't have alternate facts. And, you know, as crazy as it sounds, that there's even a concept like alternate facts. The reality is, you know, educational institutions across the country, throughout the world, have no trouble identifying things that are true. It's the foundation of our educational system globally, you know. So, you know, there may be outliers and people who feel like, you know, it's advantageous to pretend that there's an alternate universe. The reality is, you know, most sane people can agree when things are true, and that becomes the basis of reestablishing a trustworthy space where any citizen and all citizens can go to get educational material that they know is factually correct. Now, it's not going to necessarily change their view, but it'll certainly influence their view in order to know that what they're forming their view around are true things, not spin, not something that a bot has, you know, trolled an entire community on Facebook. You know, this is part of the big part of the problem that we're dealing with right now is that, you know, individual citizens have come to depend upon social networks like Facebook. Unfortunately, currently and in the 2016 election, almost 65% of voters got their primary news source from Facebook. And what we've since learned is that news has been completely tailored down to the individual, based on a record of clicks and actions that each individual has taken while on Facebook, that's left a trail that can be manipulated easily, so that, you know, on election day or during a campaign, you know, what you hear and see in terms of news may be completely different than what your spouse sees on a different computer, just because you may have a slightly different personal history of what you click on, you know, let alone your neighbors, let alone, you know, your, you know, people on the other side of the political divide.
Well, you know,
that makes sense, Steve?
Yeah, you've brought up a number of interesting things here, and one of them has to do with the very simple idea of when people are engaging in a system like this, they are temporarily withdrawing from their own silo, from the information stream that comes to them. You know, and you said earlier that when people are much more likely, I think, on a system like that, like this, to make more considered decisions rather than looking around to see what their friends are doing or the other people who believe the way they do. And it's a way to, as we said earlier, be somewhat independent from your political tribe. Now, we have a very, very unique situation right now, bordering on constitutional crisis, where we have a president who is pretty much flouted any kind of respect for the law. And he's floated the idea, well, if I don't like the election results, I might not leave, and so on. Were we to have this advisory voting platform that would be completely independent, by the way, of government, for-profit corporations, mainstream media, political parties, and this is very important, there is no such institution with that level of independence. If we had that in place right now, how might that shape our conversation about what's about to unfold between now and the inauguration?
Well, you know, with that capability in place, I mean, let me start by saying, clearly we have an electorate that is far more engaged in this particular election than maybe any other, certainly in our lifetimes. Because there's so much at stake when the institutions themselves that we are, you know, used to taking for granted are suddenly at risk. But if this advisory voting capability were here today, and all of us had access to our individual advisory voting accounts, certain things might not be subject to controversy. You know, for instance, the Supreme Court nomination, right, of Amy Barrett. The polls, again, indicate that the vast majority of Americans are not in favor of ramming through GOP selected, Trump-elected candidate for the court, especially after Trump has bragged that he wants to have her in place so that if the election results end up being thrown to the Supreme Court, he'll have his person there to guarantee that the court rules his way. I mean, it's mind-boggling that he's willing to even say that out loud, admit it, let alone brag about it. But back to your question, if we had advisory voting right now, there would be a counterbalance available, because if this is something that people care about, and I know you know that they, we do, you know, imagine if suddenly there were more people who turned out in the next, you know, week to cast an advisory vote. And by the way, the advisory vote doesn't have to be on one day. It's a rolling, right? So it would increase over time. It's a voting window. But saw as many or more people coming out to voice their views on whether or not the Supreme Court pick should be left to the next president, as opposed to being, basically hijacked by the lame duck the Senate and this president. If 150 million people turn and say no, you know, same as the poll, 70%, we hate. Well, I think that would make it much more obvious that forcing the nomination is like, at that point, would be perhaps a suicidal political move. Whereas now, there's no counterbalance. I mean, there aren't protests in the street yet because it hasn't happened yet. That there's no way to provide an advance public sentiment on even the possibility. You know, we're like bystanders watching the cable news, hearing people argue over whether it should or shouldn't happen, but nobody is asking us what we think, us being we the people, regardless of political party. I mean, I don't even care where you end up on the issue, just the idea that you do not have a voice. You can be a, you know, strong Trump supporter, you do not have a voice. You know, you can be in favor of, you know, or against anything, you do not have a voice at all in between elections. Your voices come down to, and this is not just at this moment, but always between elections, the only thing you have that approximates a voice is the ability to sign a petition. And when was the last time you heard of a petition changing anything? People know it. It just breeds cynicism. And the only other way you have a voice is if you literally, physically go out in the streets, protest with your body and risk being, you know, run over by a car or, you know, shot with rubber bullets. I mean, it's asking a lot. And, you know, God bless the, you know, patriotic Americans who are willing to go and put their public safety, their personal safety on the line in order to have some kind of say. But having an advisory voting capability would allow everybody to show up. Like, instead of just taking to the streets, take to the screens, which is safe. You do it from home. Doesn't mean don't go out in the streets. You can have a voice in between elections. You can have a voice before there's a crisis. You know, we don't have a voice at the table of democracy except every 2 years. In between, it's useless petitions or protests in the streets. That's it. That's civic engagement. And we have what I believe is an historic opportunity to change that and to establish something that is possible for the first time in our country's history, in our world's history. And frankly, having success in establishing that advisory voice here will be a model for other countries and other democracies around the world.
This is freedom of assembly 3.0, because again, not everybody can go out in the street. Not everybody wants to go out in the street. Counting those people can be problematical. It's subject to interpretation. Donald Trump's huge crowd for inauguration and so on. But what we're talking about here is an institution that is completely independent from the other influencers. They're independent from political parties, from the government, from corporations, from for-profit ventures, and from mainstream media. And so here you can trust that, you know, pretty much, remember the old days when in the Academy Awards and when somebody bought the winner, you know, the little briefcase right. from Price Waterhouse, right? And everybody knew, yeah. up until a couple of years ago anyway, everybody knew that that was accurate and they could be trusted. And so what right. would it be like to know that when you see at the National Town Square, whatever we decide to call it, that, you know, X number of million Americans showed up in droves and 80% of those say this, it can't be discounted, not just by the professional politicians, but what's even more important to me, and see if you agree, that we the people begin to see our coherence. We the people begin to see, wow, we really agree on that, and these two political parties won't give it to us. So it creates, it shifts public opinion into public will so that we willingly stand up for something. And this is the legacy of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence indicated that the sovereign of this nation is not some king, but it's the collective entity called we the people. That's who this was established for. And, you know, this is going to re-enfranchise us in a very, very significant way. We're going to take a break very shortly, but the question I want to ask you for when we come back, and we might be able to begin here, is that, you know, your background for the last 25 years or so, at least, has been in the tech industry. And so you've been an observer to how technology has helped us and also hindered us. So I'm sure you have, we're going to talk more about the recent revelations about social media with Richard Lang when we get back after this break on Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, we're back on Wiki Politiki. We're talking with Richard Lang. We're talking about advisory voting. And we're also going to talk about the tech industry. You know, you've been involved with this for many years. I'm sure you have some thoughts on recent revelations about how social media puts us in silos, feeds us material that is designed to polarize and stir us up, and also makes us susceptible to bots and other external influences on our behavior. What do you see as the problem here, and how can we actually address it?
So, if I may, let me approach the question slightly differently, which is to underscore the idea of being counted. Okay, and what being counted means for a collective citizenry. Right. So, you know, it almost sounds too simple. What is advisory voting about? Ultimately, it's about being counted. And unless our votes are counted, they don't count, literally. I'm not trying to be funny.
Yeah, no, that's true.
So, you know, they're not counted. So the idea, it's not very difficult. And this sort of ties into your question about my tech background. I mean, I can tell you just from a technology standpoint, counting ourselves is not very difficult. It's not rocket science. You know, authenticating and taking a head count of 240 million people is not that big a deal. I mean, you know, obviously there's security issues, but when people think about security and hackers and you know, denial of service attacks, we typically hear about it in the context of a large company has been hacked, a social network is under attack. You know, usually millions, if not tens of millions or even billions of what I call access points where mischief can happen. But this is sort of the polar opposite. This is like a singular, if you can picture just this one thing that advisory voting can do, one primary thing after education, and that is to count ourselves. You know, really the initiative to establish advisory voting is about establishing a mechanism for we the people to count ourselves. And the first benefit that accrues from that is we stop being a nation of, you know, endlessly multiple views on everything spread everywhere, you know, in all these places and comment streams and social networks and arguments. And, you know, instead, there's one location. It's this is the issue. And now that you've got the education, let us count you. Let us count ourselves. And that's a huge responsibility because we only need one counting place. The National Town Square is what I call it in my book, Virtual Country. But, you know, ultimately, the National Town Square is the venue, but the ability is the ability to count ourselves. And that creates instant coherence as a population of citizens. It's no longer scattered. It's now focused in one spot on one thing at one time. And, you know, that's really the historic opportunity. So, you know, my background is in tech. You know, I mean, you know, years ago started as at the consumer electronics level. I was co-inventor of the dual deck video cassette recorder, which seems pretty funny 30 years later. But anyway, at the time it was a breakthrough and, you know, it was sold all over the world. You know, the other technology had to do with network optimization, which is what made video on demand possible. And then, you know, finally in the company that I'm still CEO of, Democrosoft, is focused on online collaboration and voting. And again, you know, we're really just, I can tell you that the tech piece is easy. But where tech gets out of control is when it gets so big that it's no longer manageable, or if it is manageable, it's entirely dependent upon the ethics of those who own it. And typically those are for-profit shareholders and sometimes, you know, CEOs or presidents of, you know, who have very different views about what's important. It's either going to be public service. No, it's going to be making profits for yourself and for your shareholders. And that's great in the corporate world, but this is democracy, and democracy should not be monetized.
You know, your book, Virtual Country, came out, I'm thinking about 3 years, right? 3 years ago? 2017?
Two and a half years. It'll be three years in January. Yeah.
Okay, so almost 3 years. And I know that you've been working very steadily on getting this idea out there in the world and getting it adopted. What have been the obstacles that you've encountered in getting those who have the influence to kind of back this issue and perhaps fund it? What have been the obstacles that you've encountered so far?
Well, so first let me say that because we know that the technology part is not an obstacle, right? So the real obstacle in the general sense is creating something as a singular national institution and capability that has public trust. And you know, ultimately that rests upon, well, who's involved, right? Who are the people who, at least initially, like, are the ones that are all standing on stage and saying, you know, we're announcing this, and here is how it's going to run, and here are the rules. And so who are these people? And so the efforts of the past 3 years have really been focused on building a cohort of individuals. Most of them, I would say, probably well-known, not all of them, but people, when they are well-known, they're known for their integrity. And, you know, that's becoming a scarce resource, but probably the most valuable one. So now let me answer your question with regards to people of integrity. That's sort of our first filter, right? Where are the obstacles? The biggest obstacle is that of shifting paradigms. The biggest one, because, you know, your listeners know, with a paradigm shift, until you make it, you don't even know what, you know, what anybody is referring to. After you understand it, after you make that shift, then everything's obvious. So the first one is that people are stuck in a paradigm of thinking of civic engagement as an election-centric process only. And that's why as soon as one election is over, media immediately starts talking about the next election. You know, within weeks, we're talking about what's going to happen next general election. So getting out of that box where we're only thinking about electing people is perhaps the single biggest obstacle. Most people can make that jump, but, you know, it takes some time and some education. The other sort of practical obstacle, and it's part of the paradigm shift, is that, you know, many people, we're not used to thinking in terms of citizens being engaged. So the question comes up, well, you know, what's going to motivate people to participate, right, to sign up? And, you know, we point out that no one's signing up. We're asking citizens to recognize that there's an advisory voting account waiting for them that they can claim. There's a personal voice ready to be of theirs to be added to a collective. And it's unlike regular voting where it's going to happen on a certain day. You got to get a ride to the polls. Maybe you have to get off work. You got to get a babysitter. Advisory voting is not focused on a single day. There are windows of time to weigh in, and the process of accessing the personal, your voting booth, is literally reaching into your pocket or your purse and logging into your voting account. And, you know, the idea that how are we going to get 100 million or 200 million people to participate, it's a paradigm shift. But once people realize, oh shoot, I can vote, you know, while I'm sitting on the couch. You know, I don't have to go anywhere. I can just weigh in because I have a view. I can become educated while I'm, you know, laying by the pool. And that's the primary obstacle is helping people recognize how different it is. We're just not used to thinking in terms of non-election civic engagement. This is a new category almost, advisory voting is the name of it.
You know, that makes total sense, and I really like the idea of claiming something that is already yours. We have set this up for you, and you can come claim it. That's a lot different than, asking somebody to initiate something. It's ready to claim, like your Social Security is ready to claim at a certain age. Your right to vote essentially is ready to claim. So I think that's a very clear ask. And at the same time, I think that, you know, people who are involved in electoral politics, the folks at Harvard University called it the political industrial complex, seem to be bought into this system and this little pesky little new institution that is so trustworthy that none of these other wheeler dealers can actually have control over it. It's a pretty formidable, radical idea.
But it's easy. Sorry, go ahead, Steve.
No, go ahead. You're going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, we have three branches of government. And if any one of those three branches of government makes some major statement in some way, passes a law, president makes a tweet or, whatever it is, immediately news media is all over it, social media is all over it because they've each had a say. But now, enter this fourth, think of it as a virtual branch of government because it's not part of government. It's non-governmental. It's non-corporate. It's a nonprofit assembly of citizens that has a voice. When that virtual fourth branch shows up in enough numbers to make a statement, it's going to have the same media attention, social media spread as the other three branches. It's ours to claim.
That is a really excellent way to look at it. In looking at where you are now with this project and so on and where you've been, what signs, what are the hopeful, encouraging signs that you've seen that this is something that will be established as a true upgrade of democracy?
Well, in a way, it's inevitable that it's going to come to pass. The issue is not so much, if or even when, because it's probably going to be sooner than we think. The issue is who's going to own it, who's going to run it. And so, the time and effort that we're putting in is completely directed at building a new institution that has integrity and that is deemed trustworthy from day one and that never changes, because we only get one chance to do this, and it's important to do it right.
That's a really good point. So, in other words, it would be very easy for some institution like Facebook or Google to pick up on this and go, "Wow, we can do that, and we can take the basic kernel of truth in the idea, and we can build it into our already existing system." And this window of opportunity for true democracy, true independence on the part of our voters would be lost. So sounds like it's a high priority to find the stewards and conveners of this new institution and establish its trustworthiness and independence rather quickly.
No, that's right. And it does take the time that it takes because, when it comes to integrity, it's one area you can't cut corners. And, we've had opportunities to align, with individuals or groups that did not strike us as having the best interests of we the people really at heart, because it's so tempting to see, to the nation, it could look just the same. It could be called advisory voting. It could, kind of what you just said a minute ago, everything the same, but on the, what we in the tech industry call in the back end, right, where the data happens, citizens engaging, it could become, you think that they're collecting information now. Wait till it's collected on a advisory voting platform that doesn't follow the operating principles that say, for instance, no data collection. We don't want to know what party you're at. The data could be a source of immense monetization and wealth for companies, for corporations. Unfortunately, once you start selling data, then it starts getting manipulated. And I think Facebook is unfortunately the prime example of what can go wrong, that some people who are closely associated with Facebook have referred to it as the Frankenstein monster because it's no longer trustworthy. And yet it's very difficult for people to quit it. Now, that's a bad combo. So what you don't want to do is introduce democracy into that environment at all.
The environments are very, very important. I think that as we're coming to realize, there are environments that encourage people to step away from their preconceptions and to embrace new possibilities. And then there are others that create enough fear to force people back into their silos and trenches and so on. You came up with an idea, a phrase, I heard you say it a couple of years ago, an ecosystem for civic engagement. And when I heard that statement, what I realized is that there is an untapped wisdom of the crowds, untapped wisdom of ordinary people coming up with extraordinary solutions. And it's just amazing to me that this is such an untapped resource and hasn't been used yet. And I can see that the National Town Square Advisory Voting Module, because it actually counts people, is kind of the crown jewel of this ecosystem. So are you seeing other ways along with this that people can begin to engage with one another and participate more? Civic engagement, engage in a civil way. Whoops, I guess I've talked myself to the end of the show, Richard.
Well, I encourage your listeners to go to advisoryvote.us, and there's information on that site.
There's a great little video there. Thank you, Richard Lang, for joining us on WikiPolitiki today and presenting this extraordinary opportunity. This is Steve Bierman. I'll be back with you next week on WikiPolitiki.